on the dual monarchy as a German state, and believed that it could be relied on. They assumed that its strength could be measured by the millions of its subjects, as was the case in Germany. First of all, they did not realize that Austria had ceased to be a German state, and secondly, that the conditions prevailing within the Austrian Empire were steadily pushing it headlong to the brink of disaster. At that time, I knew the conditions of affairs in the Austrian state better than the professional diplomats. Blindfolded, as nearly always, these diplomats stumbled along on their way to disaster. The opinions prevailing among the bulk of the people reflected only what had been drummed into them from official quarters above. And these higher authorities grovelled before the ally, as the people of old bowed down before the golden calf. They probably thought that by being polite and amiable, they might balance the lack of honesty on the other side. Thus they took every declaration at its full face value. Even while in Vienna, I used to be annoyed again and again by the discrepancy between the speeches of the official statesmen and the contents of the Viennese press. And yet, Vienna was still a German city, at least as far as appearances went. But one encountered an utterly different state of things on leaving Vienna, or rather German Austria, and coming to the Slav provinces. It needed only a glance at the Prague newspapers in order to see how the whole exalted hocus-pocus of the Triple Alliance was judged from there. In Prague, there was nothing but jibes and sneers for that masterpiece of statesmanship. Even in the piping times of peace, when the two emperors kissed each other on the brow in token of friendship, those papers did not cloak their belief that the alliance would be liquidated the moment a first attempt was made to bring it down from the shimmering glory of a Nibelungen ideal to the plane of practical affairs. Great indignation was aroused a few years later when the alliances were put to the first practical test. Italy not only withdrew from the Triple Alliance, leaving the other two members to march by themselves, but she even joined their enemies. That anybody should believe even for a moment in the possibility of such a miracle as that of Italy fighting on the same side as Austria would be simply incredible to anyone who did not suffer from the blindness of official diplomacy. And that was just how people felt in Austria also. In Austria, only the Habsburgs and the German Austrians supported the alliance. The Habsburgs did so from shrewd calculation of their own interests and from necessity. The Germans did it out of good faith and political ignorance. They acted in good faith inasmuch as they believed that by establishing the Triple Alliance, they were doing a great service to the German Empire, and were thus helping to strengthen it and consolidate its defence. They showed their political ignorance, however, in holding such ideas, because instead of helping the German Empire, they really chained it to a moribund state, which might bring its associate into the grave with itself. And above all, by championing this alliance, they fell more and more a prey to the Habsburg policy of de-Germanization. For the alliance gave the Habsburgs good grounds for believing that the German Empire would not interfere in their domestic affairs, and thus they were in a position to carry into effect, with more ease and less risk, their domestic policy of gradually eliminating the German element. Not only could the objectiveness of the German government be counted upon, and thus there need be no fear of protest from that quarter, but one could always remind the German Austrians of the alliance, and thus silence them in case they should ever object to the reprehensible means that were being employed to establish a Slav hegemony in the dual monarchy. What could the German Austrians do when the people of the German Empire itself had openly proclaimed their trust and confidence in the Habsburg regime? Should they resist, and thus be branded openly before their kinsfolk in the Reich as traitors to their own national interests? They, who for so many decades had sacrificed so much for the sake of their German tradition. Once the influence of the Germans in Austria had been wiped out, what then would be the value of the alliance? If the Triple Alliance were to be advantageous to Germany, was it not a necessary condition that the predominance of the German element in Austria should be maintained? Or did anyone really believe that Germany could continue to be the ally of a Habsburg Empire under the hegemony of the Slavs? The official attitude of German diplomacy, as well as that of the general public towards internal problems affecting the Austrian nationalities, was not merely stupid. It was insane. On the alliance, as on a solid foundation, they grounded the security and future existence of a nation of 70 millions, while at the same time they allowed their partner to continue his policy of undermining the sole foundation of that alliance methodically and resolutely from year to year. A day must come when nothing but a formal contract with Viennese diplomats would be left. The alliance itself, as an effective support, would be lost to Germany. As far as concerned Italy, such had been the case from the outset. If people in Germany had studied history and the psychology of nations a little more carefully, not one of them could have believed for a single hour that the Quirinal and the Viennese Hofburg could ever stand shoulder to shoulder on a common battlefront. Italy would have exploded like a volcano if any Italian government had dared to send a single Italian soldier to fight for the Habsburg state. So fanatically hated was this state that the Italians could stand in no other relation to it on a battlefront except as enemies. More than once in Vienna I have witnessed explosions of the contempt and profound hatred which allied the Italian to the Austrian state. The crimes which the House of Habsburg committed against Italian freedom and independence during several centuries were too grave to be forgiven, even with the best of goodwill. But this goodwill did not exist, either among the rank and file of the population or in the government. Therefore, for Italy, there were only two ways of coexisting with Austria: alliance or war. By choosing the first, it was possible to prepare leisurely for the second. Especially since relations between Russia and Austria tended more and more towards the arbitrament of war, the German policy of alliances was as senseless as it was dangerous. Here was a classical instance which demonstrated the lack of any broad or logical lines of thought. But what was the reason for forming the alliance at all? It could not have been other than the wish to secure the future of the Reich better than if it were to depend exclusively on its own resources. But the future of the Reich could not have meant anything else than the problem of securing the means of existence for the German people. The only questions, therefore, were the following: what form shall the life of the nation assume in the near future, that is to say, within such a period as we can forecast, and by what means can the necessary foundation and security be guaranteed for this development within the framework of the general distribution of power amongst the European nations. A clear analysis of the principles on which the foreign policy of German statecraft were to be based should have led to the following conclusions. The annual increase of population in Germany amounts to almost 900,000 souls. The difficulties of providing for this army of new citizens must grow from year to year, and must finally lead to catastrophe, unless ways and means are found which will forestall the danger of misery and hunger. There were four ways of providing against this terrible calamity.
File 29.
1. It was possible to accept the French example and artificially restrict the number of births, thus avoiding an excess of population. Under certain circumstances, in periods of distress or under bad climatic condition, or if the soil yields too poor a return, nature herself tends to check the increase of population in some countries and among some races, but by a method which is quite as ruthless as it is wise. It does not impede the procreative faculty as such, but it does impede the further existence of the offspring by submitting it to such tests and privations that everything which is less strong or less healthy is forced to retreat into the bosom of the unknown. Whatever survives these hardships of existence has been tested and tried a thousandfold, hardened and rendered fit to continue the process of procreation, so that the same thorough selection will begin all over again. By thus dealing brutally with the individual, and recalling him the very moment he shows that he is not fitted for the trials of life, nature preserves the strength of the race and the species, and raises it to the highest degree of efficiency. The decrease in numbers, therefore, implies an increase of strength, as far as the individual is concerned, and this finally means the invigoration of the species. But the case is different when man himself starts the process of numerical restriction. Man is not carved from nature's wood. He is made of human material. He knows more than the ruthless queen of wisdom. He does not impede the preservation of the individual, but prevents procreation itself. To the individual, who always sees only himself and not the race, this line of action seems more humane and just than the opposite way. But unfortunately, the consequences are also the opposite. By leaving the process of procreation unchecked, and by submitting the individual to the hardest preparatory tests in life, nature selects the best from an abundance of single elements and stamps them as fit to live and carry on the conservation of the species. But man restricts the procreative faculty, and strives obstinately to keep alive at any cost whatever once has been born. This correction of the divine will seems to him to be wise and humane, and he rejoices at having trumped nature's card in one game at least, and thus proved that she is not entirely reliable. The dear little ape of an almighty father is delighted to see and hear that he has succeeded in effecting a numerical restriction. But he would be very displeased if told that this, his system, brings about a degeneration in personal quality. For as soon as the procreative faculty is thwarted, and the number of births diminished, the natural struggle for existence, which allows only healthy and strong individuals to survive, is replaced by a sheer craze to save feeble and even diseased creatures at any cost. And thus the seeds are sown for a human progeny which will become more and more miserable from one generation to another, as long as nature's will is scorned. But if that policy be carried out, the final results must be that such a nation will eventually terminate its own existence on this earth. For though man may defy the eternal laws of procreation during a certain period, vengeance will follow sooner or later. A stronger race will oust that which has grown weak, for the vital urge, in its ultimate form, will burst asunder all the absurd chains of this so-called humane consideration for the individual, and will replace it with the humanity of nature, which wipes out what is weak in order to give place to the strong. Any policy which aims at securing the existence of a nation by restricting the birth rate robs that nation of its future. 2. A second solution is that of internal colonization. This is a proposal which is frequently made in our own time, and one hears it lauded a good deal. It is a suggestion that is well meant, but is misunderstood by most people, so that it is the source of more mischief than can be imagined. It is certainly true that the productivity of the soil can be increased within certain limits, but only within defined limits, and not indefinitely. By increasing the productive powers of the soil, it will be possible to balance the effect of a surplus birth rate in Germany for a certain period of time without running any danger of hunger. But we have to face the fact that the general standard of living is rising more quickly than even the birth rate. The requirements of food and clothing are becoming greater from year to year, and are out of proportion to those of our ancestors of, let us say, 100 years ago. It would therefore be a mistaken view that every increase in the productive powers of the soil will supply the requisite conditions for an increase in the population. No, that is true up to a certain point only. For at least a portion of the increased produce of the soil will be consumed by the margin of increased demands caused by the steady rise in the standard of living. But even if these demands were to be curtailed to the narrowest limits possible, and if, at the same time, we were to use all our available energies in the intense cultivation, we should here reach a definite limit, which is conditioned by the inherent nature of the soil itself. No matter how industriously we may labour, we cannot increase agricultural production beyond this limit. Therefore, though we may postpone the evil hour of distress for a certain time, it will arrive at last. The first phenomenon will be the recurrence of famine periods from time to time, after bad harvests, etc. The intervals between these famines will become shorter and shorter the more the population increases. And finally, the famine times will disappear only in those rare years of plenty when the granaries are full. And a time will ultimately come when even in those years of plenty there will be not enough to go round, so that hunger will dog the footsteps of the nation. Nature must now step in once more, and select those who are to survive, or else man will help himself by artificially preventing his own increase, with all the fatal consequences for the race and the species, which have already been mentioned. It may be objected here that, in one form or another, this future is in store for all mankind, and that the individual nation or race cannot escape the general fate. At first glance, that objection seems logical enough, but we have to take the following into account. The day will certainly come when the whole of mankind will be forced to check the augmentation of the human species, because there will be no further possibility of adjusting the productivity of the soil to the perpetual increase in the population. Nature must then be allowed to use her own methods, or man may possibly take the task of regulation into his own hands, and establish the necessary equilibrium by the application of better means than we have at our disposal today. But then it will be a problem for mankind as a whole. Whereas now, only those races have to suffer from want, which no longer have the strength and daring to acquire sufficient soil to fulfill their needs. For as things stand today, vast spaces still lie uncultivated all over the surface of the globe. Those spaces are only waiting for the ploughshare. And it is quite certain that nature did not set those territories apart as the exclusive pastures of any one nation or race to be held unutilized in reserve for the future. Such land awaits the people who have the strength to acquire it and the diligence to cultivate it. Nature knows no political frontiers. She begins by establishing life on this globe, and then watches the free play of forces. Those who show the greatest courage and industry are the children nearest to her heart, and they will be granted the sovereign right of existence. If a nation confines itself to internal colonization, while other races are perpetually increasing their territorial annexations all over the globe, that nation will be forced to restrict the numerical growth of its population at a time when the other nations are increasing theirs. This situation must eventually arrive. It will arrive soon if the territory which the nation has at its disposal be small. Now, it is unfortunately true that only too often the best nations, or to speak more exactly, the only really cultured nations, who at the same time are the chief bearers of human progress, have decided, in their blind pacifism, to refrain from the acquisition of new territory, and to be content with internal colonization. But at the same time, nations of inferior quality succeed in getting hold of large spaces for colonization all over the globe. The state of affairs which must result from this contrast is the following. Races which are culturally superior, but less ruthless, would be forced to restrict their increase because of insufficient territory to support the population, while less civilized races could increase indefinitely, owing to the vast territories at their disposal. In other words, should that state of affairs continue, then the world will one day be possessed by that portion of mankind which is culturally inferior, but more active and energetic. A time will come, even though in the distant future, when there can only be two alternatives. Either the world will be ruled according to our modern concept of democracy, and then every decision will be in favour of the numerically stronger races, or the world will be governed by the law of natural distribution of power, and then those nations will be victorious who are of more brutal will and are not the nations who have practiced self-denial. Nobody can doubt that this world will one day be the scene of dreadful struggles for existence on the part of mankind. In the end, the instinct of self-preservation alone will triumph. Before its consuming fire, this so-called humanitarianism, which connotes only a mixture of fatuous timidity and self-conceit, will melt away as under the March sunshine. Man has become great through perpetual struggle. In perpetual peace, his greatness must decline.
File 30.
For us Germans, the slogan of internal colonization is fatal, because it encourages the belief that we have discovered a means which is in accordance with our innate pacifism, and which will enable us to work for our livelihood in a half-slumbering existence. Such a teaching, once it were taken seriously by our people, would mean the end of all effort to acquire for ourselves that place in the world which we deserve. If the average German were once convinced that by this means he has the chance of ensuring his livelihood and guaranteeing his future, any attempt to take an active and profitable part in sustaining the vital demands of his country would be out of the question. Should the nation agree to such an attitude, then any really useful foreign policy might be looked upon as dead and buried, together with all hope for the future of the German people. Once we know what the consequences of this internal colonization theory would be, we can no longer consider as a mere accident the fact that among those who inculcate this quite pernicious mentality among our people, the Jew is always in the first line. He knows his softies only too well not to know that they are ready to be the grateful victims of every swindle which promises them a gold block in the shape of a discovery that will enable them to outwit nature and thus render superfluous the hard and inexorable struggle for existence, so that finally they may become lords of the planet partly by sheer dolce far niente, and partly by working when a pleasing opportunity arises. It cannot be too strongly emphasized that any German internal colonization must first of all be considered as suitable only for the relief of social grievances. To carry out a system of internal colonization, the most important preliminary measure would be to free the soil from the grip of the speculator and assure that freedom. But such a system could never suffice to assure the future of the nation without the acquisition of new territory. If we adopt a different plan, we shall soon reach a point beyond which the resources of our soil can no longer be exploited, and at the same time we shall reach a point beyond which our manpower cannot develop. In conclusion, the following must be said. The fact that only up to a limited extent can internal colonization be practiced in a national territory which is of definitely small area, and the restriction of the procreative faculty which follows as a result of such conditions, these two factors have a very unfavorable effect on the military and political standing of a nation. The extent of the national territory is a determining factor in the external security of the nation. The larger the territory which a people has at its disposal, the stronger are the national defenses of that people. Military decisions are more quickly, more easily, more completely and more effectively gained against a people occupying a national territory which is restricted in area than against states which have extensive territories. Moreover, the magnitude of a national territory is in itself a certain assurance that an outside power will not hastily risk the adventure of an invasion. For in that case, the struggle would have to be long and exhausting before victory could be hoped for. the risk being so great, there would have to be extraordinary reasons for such an aggressive adventure. Hence it is that the territorial magnitude of a state furnishes a base whereon national liberty and independence can be maintained with relative ease, while, on the contrary, a state whose territory is small offers a natural temptation to the invader. As a matter of fact, so-called national circles in the German Reich rejected those first two possibilities of establishing a balance between the constant numerical increase in the population and a national territory which could not expand proportionately. But the reasons given for that rejection were different from those which I have just expounded. It was mainly on the basis of certain moral sentiments that restriction of the birth rate was objected to. Proposals for internal colonization were rejected indignantly because it was suspected that such a policy might mean an attack on the big landowners, and that this attack might be the forerunner of a general assault against the principle of private property as a whole. The form in which the latter solution, internal colonization, was recommended justified the misgivings of the big landowners. But the form in which the colonization proposal was rejected was not very clever as regards the impression which such rejection might be calculated to make on the mass of the people, and anyhow it did not go to the root of the problem at all. Only two further ways were left open, in which work and bread could be secured for the increasing population. 3. It was possible to think of acquiring new territory on which a certain portion of the increasing population could be settled each year, or else 4. Our industry and commerce had to be organized in such a manner as to secure an increase in the exports and thus be able to support our people by the increased purchasing power accruing from the profits made on foreign markets. Therefore, the problem was a policy of territorial expansion or a colonial and commercial policy. Both policies were taken into consideration, examined, recommended, and rejected from various standpoints, with the result that the second alternative was finally adopted. The sounder alternative, however, was undoubtedly the first. The principle of acquiring new territory, on which the surplus population could be settled, has many advantages to recommend it, especially if we take the future as well as the present into account. In the first place, too much importance cannot be placed on the necessity for adopting a policy which will make it possible to maintain a healthy peasant class as the basis of the national community. Many of our present evils have their origin exclusively in the disproportion between the urban and rural portions of the population. A solid stock of small and medium farmers has at all times been the best protection which a nation could have against the social diseases that are prevalent today. Moreover, that is the only solution which guarantees the daily bread of a nation within the framework of its domestic national economy. With this condition once guaranteed, industry and commerce would retire from the unhealthy position of foremost importance which they hold today, and would take their due place within the general scheme of national economy, adjusting the balance between demand and supply. Thus, industry and commerce would no longer constitute the basis of the national subsistence, but would be auxiliary institutions. By fulfilling their proper function, which is to adjust the balance between national production and national consumption, they render the national subsistence more or less independent of foreign countries, and thus assure the freedom and independence of the nation, especially at critical junctures in its history. Such a territorial policy, however, cannot find its fulfilment in the Cameroons, but almost exclusively here in Europe. One must calmly and squarely face the truth that it certainly cannot be part of the dispensation of divine providence to give a 50 times larger share of the soil in this world to one nation than to another. In considering this state of affairs today, one must not allow existing political frontiers to distract attention from what ought to exist on principles of strict justice. If this earth has sufficient room for all, then we ought to have that share of the soil which is absolutely necessary for our existence. Of course, people will not voluntarily make that accommodation. At this point, the right of self-preservation comes into effect. And when attempts to settle the difficulty in an amicable way are rejected, the clenched hand must take by force that which was refused to the open hand of friendship. If, in the past, our ancestors had based their political decisions on similar pacifist nonsense as our present generation does, we should not possess more than one-third of the national territory that we possess today, and probably there would be no German nation to worry about its future in Europe. No, we owe the two eastern marks of the empire to the natural determination of our forefathers in their struggle for existence, and thus it is to the same determined policy that we owe the inner strength which is based on the extent of our political and racial territories, and which alone has made it possible for us to exist up to now. And there is still another reason why that solution would have been the correct one. Many contemporary European states are like pyramids standing on their apexes. The European territory which these states possess is ridiculously small when compared with the enormous overhead weight of their colonies, foreign trade, etc. It may be said that they have the apex in Europe and the base of the pyramid all over the world, quite different from the United States of America, which has its base on the American continent and is in contact with the rest of the world only through its apex. Out of that situation arises the incomparable inner strength of the USA, and the contrary situation is responsible for the weakness of most of the colonial European powers. England cannot be suggested as an argument against this assertion, though in glancing casually over the map of the British Empire, one is inclined easily to overlook the existence of a whole Anglo-Saxon world. England's position cannot be compared with that of any other state in Europe, since it forms a vast community of language and culture, together with the USA. Therefore, the only possibility which Germany had of carrying a sound territorial policy into effect was that of acquiring new territory in Europe itself. Colonies cannot serve this purpose as long as they are not suited for settlement by Europeans on a large scale. In the 19th century, it was no longer possible to acquire such colonies by peaceful means. Therefore, any attempt at such a colonial expansion would have meant an enormous military struggle. Consequently, it would have been more practical to undertake that military struggle for new territory in Europe, rather than to wage war for the acquisition of possessions abroad. Such a decision naturally demanded that the nation's undivided energies should be devoted to it. A policy of that kind, which requires for its fulfilment every ounce of available energy on the part of everybody concerned, cannot be carried into effect by half measures or in a hesitating manner. The political leadership of the German Empire should, then, have been directed exclusively to this goal. No political step should have been taken in response to other considerations than this task and the means of accomplishing it. Germany should have been alive to the fact that such a goal could have been reached only by war, and the prospect of war should have been faced with calm and collected determination. The whole system of alliances should have been envisaged and valued from that standpoint. If new territory were to be acquired in Europe, it must have been mainly at Russia's cost. And once again, the new German Empire should have set out on its march along the same road as was formerly trodden by the Teutonic Knights, this time to acquire soil for the German plough by means of the German sword, and thus provide the nation with its daily bread. For such a policy, however, there was only one possible ally in Europe, and that was England.
File 31.
Only by alliance with England was it possible to safeguard the rear of the new German crusade. The justification for undertaking such an expedition was stronger than the justification which our forefathers had for setting out on theirs. Not one of our pacifists refuses to eat the bread made from the grain grown in the East. And yet the first plough here was that called the sword. No sacrifice should have been considered as too great if it was a necessary means of gaining England's friendship. Colonial and naval ambitions should have been abandoned, and attempts should not have been made to compete against British industries. Only a clear and definite policy could lead to such an achievement. Such a policy would have demanded a renunciation of the endeavour to conquer the world's markets, also a renunciation of colonial intentions and naval power. All the means of power at the disposal of the state should have been concentrated in the military forces on land. This policy would have involved a period of temporary self-denial for the sake of a great and powerful future. There was a time when England might have entered into negotiations with us on the grounds of that proposal, for England would have well understood that the problems arising from the steady increase in population were forcing Germany to look for a solution either in Europe with the help of England or, without England, in some other part of the world. This outlook was probably the chief reason why London tried to draw nearer to Germany about the turn of the century. For the first time in Germany, an attitude was then manifested which afterwards displayed itself in a most tragic way. People then gave expression to an unpleasant feeling that we might thus find ourselves obliged to pull England's chestnuts out of the fire. As if an alliance could be based on anything else than mutual give and take. And England would have become party to such a mutual bargain. British diplomats were still wise enough to know that an equivalent must be forthcoming as a consideration for any services rendered. Let us suppose that in 1904 our German foreign policy was managed astutely enough to enable us to take the part which Japan played. It is not easy to measure the greatness of the results that might have accrued to Germany from such a policy. There would have been no World War. The blood which would have been shed in 1904 would not have been a tenth of that shed from 1914 to 1918. And what a position Germany would hold in the world today! In any case, the alliance with Austria was then an absurdity. For this mummy of a state did not attach itself to Germany for the purpose of carrying through a war, but rather to maintain a perpetual state of peace, which was meant to be exploited for the purpose of slowly but persistently exterminating the German element in the dual monarchy. Another reason for the impossible character of this alliance was that nobody could expect such a state to take an active part in defending German national interests, seeing that it did not have sufficient strength and determination to put an end to the policy of de-Germanization within its own frontiers. If Germany herself was not moved by a sufficiently powerful national sentiment, and was not sufficiently ruthless to take away from that absurd Habsburg state the right to decide the destinies of 10 million inhabitants, who were of the same nationality as the Germans themselves, surely it was out of the question to expect the Habsburg state to be a collaborating party in any great and courageous German undertaking. The attitude of the old Reich towards the Austrian question might have been taken as a test of its stamina for the struggle where the destinies of the whole nation were at stake. In any case, the policy of oppression against the German population in Austria should not have been allowed to be carried on and to grow stronger from year to year, for the value of Austria as an ally could be assured only by upholding the German element there. But that, of course, was not followed. Nothing was dreaded so much as the possibility of an armed conflict. But finally, and at a most unfavourable moment, the conflict had to be faced and accepted. They thought to cut loose from the cords of destiny, but destiny held them fast. They dreamt of maintaining a world peace, and woke up to find themselves in a world war. And that dream of peace was a most significant reason why the above-mentioned third alternative for the future development of Germany was not even taken into consideration. The fact was recognized that new territory could be gained only in the east. But this meant that there would be fighting ahead, whereas they wanted peace at any cost. The slogan of German foreign policy at one time used to be the use of all possible means for the maintenance of the German nation. Now it has changed to maintenance of world peace by all possible means. We know what the result was. I shall resume the discussion of this point in detail later on. There remained still another alternative, which we may call the fourth. This was industry and world trade, naval power and colonies. Such a development might certainly have been attained more easily and more rapidly. To colonize a territory is a slow process, often extending over centuries. Yet this fact is the source of its inner strength, for it is not through a sudden burst of enthusiasm that it can be put into effect, but rather through a gradual and enduring process of growth, quite different from industrial progress, which can be urged on by advertisement within a few years. The result thus achieved, however, is not of lasting quality, but something frail, like a soap bubble. It is much easier to build quickly than to carry through the tough task of settling a territory with farmers and establishing farmsteads. But the former is more quickly destroyed than the latter. In adopting such a course, Germany must have known that to follow it would necessarily mean war sooner or later. Only children could believe that sweet and unctuous expressions of goodness and persistent avowals of peaceful intentions could get them their bananas through this friendly competition between the nations, with the prospect of never having to fight for them. No. Once we had taken this road, England was bound to be our enemy at some time or other to come. Of course, it fitted in nicely with our innocent assumptions, but still it was absurd to grow indignant at the fact that a day came when the English took the liberty of opposing our peaceful penetration with the brutality of violent egoists. Naturally, we on our side would never have done such a thing. If a European territorial policy against Russia could have been put into practice, only in case we had England as our ally, on the other hand, a colonial and world trade policy could have been carried into effect only against English interests and with the support of Russia. But then this policy should have been adopted in full consciousness of all the consequences it involved, and above all things, Austria should have been discarded as quickly as possible. At the turn of the century, the alliance with Austria had become a veritable absurdity from all points of view. But nobody thought of forming an alliance with Russia against England, just as nobody thought of making England an ally against Russia. For in either case, the final result would inevitably have meant war. And to avoid war was the very reason why a commercial and industrial policy was decided upon. It was believed that the peaceful conquest of the world by commercial means provided a method which would permanently supplant the policy of force. Occasionally, however, there were doubts about the efficiency of this principle, especially when some quite incomprehensible warnings came from England now and again. That was the reason why the fleet was built. It was not for the purpose of attacking or annihilating England, but merely to defend the concept of world peace mentioned above, and also to protect the principle of conquering the world by peaceful means. Therefore, this fleet was kept within modest limits, not only as regards the number and tonnage of the vessels, but also in regard to their armament, the idea being to furnish new proofs of peaceful intentions. The chatter about the peaceful conquest of the world by commercial means was probably the most completely nonsensical stuff ever raised to the dignity of a guiding principle in the policy of a state. This nonsense became even more foolish when England was pointed out as a typical example to prove how the thing could be put into practice. Our doctrinal way of regarding history and our professional ideas in that domain have done irreparable harm and offer a striking proof of how people learn history without understanding anything of it. As a matter of fact, England ought to have been looked upon as a convincing argument against the theory of Pacific conquest of the world by commercial means. No nation prepared the way for its commercial conquests more brutally than England did by means of the sword, and no other nation has defended such conquests more ruthlessly. Is it not a characteristic quality of British statecraft that it knows how to use political power in order to gain economic advantages, and inversely, to turn economic conquests into political power? What an astounding error it was to believe that England would not have the courage to give its own blood for the purposes of its own economic expansion. The fact that England did not possess a national army proved nothing. For it is not the actual military structure of the moment that matters, but rather the will and determination to use whatever military strength is available. England has always had the armament which she needed. She always fought with those weapons which were necessary for success. She sent mercenary troops to fight as long as mercenaries sufficed. But she never hesitated to draw heavily and deeply from the best blood of the whole nation when victory could be obtained only by such a sacrifice. And in every case the fighting spirit, dogged determination, and use of brutal means in conducting military operations have always remained the same.
File 32.
but in Germany. Through the medium of the schools, the press, and the comic papers, an idea of the Englishman was gradually formed, which was bound eventually to lead to the worst kind of self-deception. This absurdity slowly but persistently spread into every quarter of German life. The result was an undervaluation for which we have had to pay a heavy penalty. The delusion was so profound that the Englishman was looked upon as a shrewd businessman, but personally a coward, even to an incredible degree. Unfortunately, our lofty teachers of professional history did not bring home to the minds of their pupils the truth that it is not possible to build up such a mighty organization as the British Empire by mere swindle and fraud. The few who called attention to that truth were either ignored or silenced. I can vividly recall to mind the astonished looks of my comrades when they found themselves personally face to face for the first time with the Tommies in Flanders. After a few days of fighting, the consciousness slowly dawned upon our soldiers that those Scotsmen were not like the ones we had seen described and caricatured in the comic papers and mentioned in the communiques. It was then that I formed my first ideas of the efficiency of various forms of propaganda. Such a falsification, however, served the purpose of those who had fabricated it. The caricature of the Englishman, though false, could be used to prove the possibility of conquering the world peacefully by commercial means. Where the Englishman succeeded, we should also succeed. Our far greater honesty and our freedom from that specifically English perfidy would be assets on our side. Thereby it was hoped that the sympathy of the smaller nations and the confidence of the greater nations could be gained more easily. We did not realize that our honesty was an object of profound aversion for other people, because we ourselves believed in it. The rest of the world looked on our behavior as the manifestation of a shrewd deceitfulness. But when the revolution came, then they were amazed at the deeper insight it gave them into our mentality, sincere even beyond the limits of stupidity. Once we understand the part played by that absurd notion of conquering the world by peaceful commercial means, we can clearly understand how that other absurdity, the Triple Alliance, came to exist. With what state, then, could an alliance have been made? In alliance with Austria, we could not acquire new territory by military means, even in Europe. And this very fact was the real reason for the inner weakness of the Triple Alliance. Bismarck could not permit himself such a makeshift for the necessities of the moment, but certainly not any of his bungling successors. And least of all, when the foundations no longer existed on which Bismarck had formed the Triple Alliance. In Bismarck's time, Austria could still be looked upon as a German state, but the gradual introduction of universal suffrage turned the country into a parliamentary Babel, in which the German voice was scarcely audible. From the viewpoint of racial policy, this alliance with Austria was simply disastrous. A new Slavic great power was allowed to grow up close to the frontiers of the German Empire. Later on, this power was bound to adopt towards Germany an attitude different from that of Russia, for example. The alliance was thus bound to become more empty and more feeble, because the only supporters of it were losing their influence and were being systematically pushed out of the more important public offices. About the year 1900, The alliance with Austria had already entered the same phase as the alliance between Austria and Italy. Here also only one alternative was possible: either to take the side of the Habsburg monarchy, or to raise a protest against the oppression.